I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, where we are broadcasting live from Studio 4A at the NPR Studios in Washington, D.C. Thank you, everybody, for traveling with us on this wonderful journey. We've been to Gettysburg. For those of you just tuning in, we've been on the road. And we've had a very, very educational, I think our minds are just crammed. And now we went to the Smithsonian's museums yesterday, many of us, so our minds are crammed with history and aeronautics and airplanes and Apollo. And you got to live here. You got to live here, I think, for some part of your life because there is so much in this city. It's just been terrific. And we're delighted to have two guests who have had a whole lot to do with the way some of these museums function and putting all of them together. Bob van der Linden is chair of the Aeronautics Division of the National Air and Space Museum, Smithsonian. How many of you in the audience had a chance to go there yesterday? Quite a few of you. And I'm just going to let you get familiar with their voices. Bob, if you would tell us a little bit about what your responsibilities are at that fabulous museum.
I'm the chairman of the Aeronautics Division, which is the curatorial division responsible for aircraft. So my curators, and I'm a curator as well, are responsible for bringing in all the aviation artifacts into the building, into our collection. We have another department, Space History, which does the same for space objects.
And you have brought so many things. You walk in, and right off the bat, you're seeing these extraordinary moon capsules and airplanes that are famous. It's just, I didn't even know how you got them in the building. But you really collect, well, it's the Smithsonian. You just collect everything.
Not everything.
That's a history museum that does that.
No, we're a history museum, too. But it's, and technology and science. There are some aircraft out there and other places I would like to have, and I'm not going to tell the museum's that. But we were very lucky. We had this one curator for the longest time, a gentleman named Paul Garber. He was a one-man air and space museum. He came to the Smithsonian in 1920 and stayed until he died at age 92.
Oh, my.
He collected everything. And he's one responsible for us having the Spirit of St. Louis. And the Wright Flyer and the Bell X, when all the aircraft that make our collection so wonderful, he brought in personally. Hmm. Now they've been. Now we now have staff of about 200 people, but he did it all himself for the longest time.
I read on one of the little panels that it took people in this country some time to embrace flight. Were we afraid of it? We could fly, but we just didn't want to be because we were worried, or what was it?
Well, for the longest time, flight was fine for somebody else. You know, you saw it in World War I. I mean, it's great for combat. But getting somebody on an airplane, flying from point A to point B, that was something completely different. Because back in the 1920s, it was very dangerous. There was no airlines to speak of. And the aircraft were World War I vintage, which was good enough for World War I, but couldn't fly at night, couldn't fly in bad weather. No safety controls, safety features to speak of. It was very, very hazardous. Hmm. Took a lot of work by a lot of people to make it's now the safest form of transportation. It's more dangerous to walk across the street than it is to fly.
It is? Mm-hmm. Well, we'll be very careful.
Especially in
the city.
And I
hope you will be, too, as you find your way back to the museum. I spent a lot of hours yesterday at the History Museum, the National Museum of American History, which has some marvelous exhibits, and thank you very much, Brent, for being with us. And it's kind of an eclectic. You've got the shoes that Judy Garland wore in Wizard of Oz, and then
yes.
You've got this incredible exhibit on African American history with letters from Martin Luther King, and it's just in World War One and Two, and it's just such a mixture, isn't it?
Well, we try to tell the full story of American history at the museum. And it's even though we're young by the standards of many countries around the world, we have quite a complex and diverse history that includes political history and military and social and economic, technological, cultural history. And we try to show all of that at the American History Museum.
Mm-hmm. Tell me how this whole thing is fashioned. How is it decided that there's going to be a museum for history or a museum for aeronautics and space? How do people decide this? And how do you decide when you need a new museum? Do you know? Or you need to add space to yours because you got way too many planes?
Well, I think this is Washington, so it's a political process.
Oh, really?
Surprise.
And if you go back into the history of each one of the Smithsonian museums, you mentioned there are 19, plus the National Zoo, plus all the different research centers, you can find a very good political story behind each one of them. I can talk about the American History Museum.
Please.
And that we were authorized by Congress in we opened in 1964. That meant we were actually authorized several years before that to construct the museum on the National Mall with a very important location where midway between the Capitol and the Lincoln Memorial and midway between the White House and the Jefferson Memorial. So we're right in the heart of the National Mall. And at the time, that was the that was in the heart of the Cold War with the Soviet Union, and the idea of showcasing America's technology and America's progress in a number of different areas of cultural and political life was important. And so when the museum opened in 1964, the official name was the Museum of History and Technology.
Oh, really?
So the word technology was an important part of our title. And then in 1980, our Congress changed our name to the National Museum of American History, recognizing the broader scope of our collections and our exhibitions.
Hmm. It just seems so late to the game. We had so much history before 1964. It seems like it should have been there when the Capitol was built, don't you think?
Well, there was a United States National Museum, which was located in the old Arts and Industries Building.
Oh.
So there was the and that's the museum I visited as a child, and that's how I became inspired to know more about American history. I didn't know I would be the director of the American History Museum at that time, but I saw the Star Spangled Banner. I saw the Wright Flyer.
Oh.
I saw the
really
the different coins that were on display and the great collections that were displayed at that time in the Arts and Industries Building. The American History Museum was the first museum built after World War II on the National Mall. So not only politics, but financial considerations comes into play as to how much you can afford to build at any given time.
And how about air and space? How long has it been around?
Well, it depends on your definition. We've been around officially since 1946, when the Act of Congress created the National Air Museum, and that was amended in 1966 to become Air and Space Museum. The first aeronautical object in our collection came in 1876. It's a set of Chinese kites. But as with American history, we were all part of United States National Museum. And we just kept collecting and collecting and then, make light of it. You know, the walls are bursting. We just had so much, and they did too. Mm. They were the first to move out. I remember as a child seeing the aviation exhibits crammed in the corners of A&I, of the A&I building, Arts and Industries building, with the American History Collection crammed in there as well.
Mm.
And both were crying for new buildings. And it took them a while. It took us until 1976 to get our building open.
Really?
The politics.
Politics.
You know, it was authorized. The building was authorized in the mid-late 60s, and Congress had authorized a sizable sum of money to pay for it. And then because of the Vietnam War, they took the money back.
Oh, my.
And,
really?
Priorities. And when they got back to refunding us, they refunded us at a significantly smaller level. But it did authorize the building, and we were able to get that building up and running. As a bicentennial present to the nation in 1976, July 1st.
So to keep adding these museums or to keep adding to collections, we need to stay out of war. Would it be fair to say that? I mean, we'd have more money. we have more money for museums and various things. But it's not the course of history. I was thinking, because so many of us have been overwhelmed. We've just been on this whirlwind, you know, Mount Vernon and Ford's Theater, and we went to Gettysburg, and we've just been all these places of taking in so much information. And I'm wondering, because both of you go to work in your certain wonderful places every day, if there is some area of your museum, some area of knowledge that you want to learn everything in the world you can learn during your lifetime. Is there something about space? Is there something about American history that just totally captures your fancy?
That means I'm still thinking.
I'll start. I think it's with American history, I think it's so rich, and I'm very I'm interested in so many different aspects of American history, and I find myself probably reading more about cultural history, and that includes the history of museums, which I'm very interested in, the history of what we call public memory, how we actually commemorate and think about our history and how we describe our history, how we commemorate history. But I'm also interested in the history of the arts and literature and architecture. Is of great interest, and I know with our audience here, one of my favorites is Frank Lloyd Wright, and I did visit Taliesin a year ago.
Oh, you did?
And that is I really encourage everybody to visit. I think the centennial is this year of Taliesin, and it is very inspiring to go to see the birthplace and the burial place of Frank Lloyd Wright, and they have a wonderful docent program there. I had a terrific tour guide. And I think that the history of our creative people in this country needs to have more attention.
We have a beautiful – I don't know if you've been to the Art Museum in Milwaukee, but it's a Calatrava Museum, and it's celebrating its 10th anniversary this year. And there's a Frank Lloyd Wright exhibit in there that's running for the next few months right on Lake Michigan. And it is so beautiful because you got Calatrava, you got Frank Lloyd Wright, you got Lake Michigan – it just doesn't get much better.
Yeah, I also spent some time in Madison, and a good friend of mine is the director of the Historical Society of Wisconsin, which has terrific buildings and terrific collections. And Ellsworth Brown is a member of our advisory board for our museum, so we rely very strongly on his experience. And then I also visited the American Girl headquarters near Madison, because they do a wonderful job at American Girl of documenting and telling a story about what it was like to be a young girl in America in different parts of the country, and so we've developed a close working relationship with them. So I think Wisconsin has a lot of history and a lot of history of national consequence.
Bob,
well, I'm an American historian. But I love airplanes. I joke that the only problem with my job, it took my hobby away from me. But I had to get paid for it. But you know, my specialty is modern American, like the 19th and 20th century history. And I love being able to incorporate almost the classic lessons of American history with aviation history, which is something that's not studied very far and wide, but it's extremely important, especially today. For our country, I mean, it's our number one manufacturing export is aircraft. How did it come that way? I'm a business historian by training.
Really?
And so I've studied the industry, but not just the airline industry, but the manufacturing industry as well. And that just serves a constant source of fascination for me. And of course, that's ever growing and changing, for good or bad. And I'm very interested in documenting that. But I like to convince people that the story of air and space. It's not just air and space. That is a part. That's history. But we want to tell that story in a broader context of American history, and for that matter, the history of the world, because aviation and space history does not solely belong to the United States. You know, we've learned from everybody, and everyone's learned from us, and vice versa. I mean, the Wrights did invent the airplane very quickly. Europe ran with that and then came back and forth across the ocean. Now it's around the world. You know, it's a big, big story, and it's more than just learning about airplanes is more than, oh, what's the top speed of this or the wingspan of that, which is fine. Some people love that. As a model builder as a kid, that was the most important thing to me. And then I started, you know, you build the model airplanes and you read the little historical blurb in it. Hmm. You realize, you know, there's something really interesting about the airplane. Uh-huh. And after a while, I stopped building the airplane model, reading the books, and then figuring out where that fits in the context of history.
Didn't you, when you were a kid, I've always wondered, we used to dream this, when you were flying, having flying dreams were always wonderful. And we always thought, you know, part of the future was going to be we were going to have these little wings on our backs and we'd be able to fly to work and fly to the NPR Museum and studios to do this interview. Whatever happened to that? Is that still in the works?
Do you see how people drive?
Okay, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. In the literature of the 1930s, there's a lot of very futuristic stuff about flying cars and highways in the sky and flying over the cities, and everyone is flying straight lines, flying on the highways. It's like, reality is that would never in a million years happen because people don't have that kind of discipline. They don't have it on a highway, much less trying to figure it out three-dimensionally. I'll stay on the ground if that happens.
I have a really deep interest in civil rights and Abraham Lincoln and the Civil War and all of that, but I was really struck by what you have collected in terms of some of the letters that Dr. Martin Luther King, this is the day he was assassinated, that he wrote and people wrote to him, the letter to say that he would show up for the sanitation workers.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Was really very moving. It's so important. It's such an important part of our history now.
Well, this this year and last year and actually the next several years will mark 50th anniversaries of important milestones in the civil rights movement. And last year and you may have noticed we have the lunch counter from Greensboro,
yes.
North Carolina, from Woolworth's department store. Last year was the 50th anniversary of that sit-in protest, and we had three of the four surviving members of the Greensboro Four come to the Smithsonian.
Oh, did you really?
And we honored them. The secretary of the Smithsonian gave them a Smithson Medal, which is an honor that we can give to people who've made contributions to American history. And these three men were quite amazing because as college freshmen, they just taught themselves the principles of nonviolent protest, and they didn't really have any training at all except that they sort of trained each other. And to hear their story and to have them actually come and meet students who came to the museum last year to meet them and learn about their story, that was quite important. And then this year there's the 50th anniversary of the Freedom Rides, and public broadcasting is going to have in May a wonderful movie called The Freedom Rides, Freedom Riders, excuse me, and which I recommend to everyone because it's a story that has sort of become lost in our memory about how complicated it was, how dangerous a situation it was, and the different roles that Martin Luther King and President Kennedy and Attorney General Robert Kennedy played, not necessarily as leaders, but in many cases sort of following the energy of the young people from different parts of the country who had decided to ride from Washington, D.C. to New Orleans in May of 1961. So these are important stories that we tell at the American History Museum, and we also have a theatrical performance. I don't know if you saw that or not, but several times a day on the weekends, we have a young man and a young woman who play the role of a student trainers for nonviolent protest, and we gather visitors around the lunch counter and train the visitors in the principles of nonviolent protest using a manual from that period, from the early 1960s. And it's quite powerful because many of our visitors are from other countries, many young people, and one young person after this theatrical performance was finished raised his hand and said, "Did this really happen?" So it's a part of history that can easily be forgotten, I think, that we've come a long way. And I like to talk about the American History Museum as being a place where you discover the American dream. And the American dream involves overcoming barriers as well as achieving great things. So I think that lunch counter really symbolizes that part of our heritage.
It's a big hit. I mean, not the best choice of words, but it's very – people are really drawn to it, I noticed, in the museum.
Well, what's nice is that we have the lunch counter at one end of the museum, and we have this wonderful statue of George Washington at the other end.
Yeah, right.
And, I think that George Washington probably might not have approved of being depicted as a Greek god, but it is a point of great hero and then the heroism of these somewhat anonymous Americans who stepped forward at a critical moment.
Now tell me absolutely honestly, what do you think of that statue of George Washington?
As a work of art, it probably is not the best, but it has a great history to it, and it has a great history not only how it came to be made, but then what happened to it over time. And I can tell one quick story.
Sure.
If you read Dan Brown's book, The Lost Symbol, I don't know how many of you have read that, but the statue of George Washington makes a cameo appearance in that book. And when it was originally the first home of that statue was the Rotunda of the Capitol. And then it was moved to the outside into a park outside the Capitol, then moved to the castle of the Smithsonian, and then in 1964 finally moved to the Museum of American History. When Dan Brown came to the museum to do some research, and I had a chance to meet him and talk to him, I said to him, what's your next book going to be? And he said, I can't tell you, but it's going to be set in Washington. So I said, well, if you write about this statue and you write about the American History Museum, please don't kill the director of the museum. the way you did in the Da Vinci Code. So he spared,
funny.
Yeah.
That's very funny. Let's pause for a moment and we'll return and welcome questions from our studio audience. We are broadcasting today. It's the end of our glorious trip to Gettysburg and Mount Vernon in Washington. We're broadcasting live from Washington, D.C., Studio 4A at NPR. And it's going to be beautiful today. Rhonda was showing me yesterday that they had hail. She had pictures, a hailstorm last night that looks like it should have damaged everything. Unbelievable hail. And, of course, today is opening day of the Brewers in Milwaukee. So, of course, the weather is going to be pretty bad for a little while. But it's beautiful here, and we've had quite a time. So it's up to you. It's up to you in our audience. And here's our well, let's just pause. I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And I'm Kathleen Dunn. We're broadcasting live from Studio 4A at the NPR studios, and we're delighted. We're looking at some of the Smithsonian museums that many of us had a chance to see on yesterday, and we're delighted to have our guests with us talking about those museums. Joining us in our studios here, Brent Glass, who's director of the National Museum of American History, and my apologies to him. I come to work with so many papers, as you can see. Those I don't normally have a live audience. And sometimes there are too many papers, you know, and I couldn't find the right paper. So I will give him a formal introduction now. He became director of the Smithsonian's National Museum in December of 2002, and it was it's amazing how many people go through the museum, more than 4.5 million visitors. And he oversaw the Abraham Lincoln, An Extraordinary Life exhibit, which is wonderful. I've seen pictures of that. On the Water, Stories from Maritime America, as well as the presentation of 80 public programs and 2,500 theater performances. He was executive director of the Pennsylvania Historical and Museum Commission in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, a position he had for 15 years. He's an active member of the academic and cultural communities, serving on many boards to generate enthusiasm for history among the general public, and that's good. Also joining, and I didn't have a formal intro either for Bob, who is the chair of the Aeronautics Division and curator of air transportation and special purpose aircraft at the National Air and Space Museum. He is the curator responsible for the Spirit of St. Louis, as well as the Milestones of Flight Gallery, the Golden Age of Flight Gallery, and the Hall of Air Transportation, which houses the America by Air exhibition. He's written a number of books, including Airlines and Air Mail, The Post Office and the Birth of the Commercial Aviation Industry, the Boeing's 247, the first modern airliner, and the nation's hangar, the aircraft collection of the Stephen Udvar Hazy Center, Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum. I'm sorry, gentlemen. I just couldn't find the right piece of paper. So
right.
There you go. Now we know. Okay. And please, Walker, go ahead.
Hi, I'm Walker. From Wisconsin, south of Madison. I have a question for Bob. Two of them, actually. How did you guys get the shuttles from space to come in your museum, and how do you have them hanging up in your in the ceilings?
Well, we only have one shuttle. And that is the shuttle Enterprise, which never actually made it into space. That was the atmospheric test vehicle that NASA used in the late 1970s to see if the thing could actually fly. And first couple of missions, they weren't quite so sure it could fly, and they had to reprogram the computers on it. It was a fly-by-wire thing, and they did do it. Once they got finished with the atmospheric test, they transferred it to us. And now it is on display at our out at Dulles Airport or at our, forgive me, Stephen F. Udvar Hazy Center. Mm. It's spelled Hazy, but it's pronounced Hazy.
Oh, it's Hazy. Thank you.
I don't speak Magyar. Very few other people do. So I've had to learn. With spacecraft like that or aircraft same size, you know, the space shuttle is the size of a DC-9 airliner. It's huge. We have most of them out at our Dulles Center because we can fly them in there, taxi them in, and literally open a door, wheel them in, and park them. Now, downtown and in some of the, and also at the Hazy Center, we do have a lot of aircraft and spacecraft hanging from the ceilings. I must say the Air and Space Museum, when it opened, was the first aviation museum in the world ever built from the ground up as an aviation museum. They usually were housed somewhere else beforehand. And this building actually is designed to hold stuff and hold stuff from everywhere. So if you look inside the building, it's a very beautiful structure. But they've got these beams all over the place. It's designed that way. And each beam can hold, oh, I forget how many thousands of pounds.
Oh, my.
But designed specifically for that. So we bring an airplane in. We literally can drive, you put it on a flatbed truck, drive it in one end of the building, take it off, and the concrete floor is about 18 inches thick. We've got to put cranes in it and lift the aircraft or spacecraft off, and then literally just hoist it up in the ceiling and connect it with cables. Sounds easy.
Thanks, Walker.
Thank you.
How do you decide how long an exhibit stays, and is there any correlation between news operations and history in space museums and airplane museums, in that somebody pitches an idea, hey, what we really ought to have is this in our museum, and let's think about it for 10 years hence, or this is something current, we need to have it in this year. How do you come up with, A, the ideas, and then the obvious second part of the question is how those will be exhibited?
Well, most museums, and I'm sure American history is the same way, we have long-term exhibit plans, and then we have short-term ones. Mm. And we can be pretty flexible. A lot of it depends on funding. But, I mean, we right now have just little boards. You may have seen them throughout the building. If someone of note has passed away recently, we'll put a little obit on it so we can at least stay current.
I see.
With stuff like that. In my America by Air exhibit, we've got sort of like a what's new display. I mean, that the exhibit is about the history of the airline industry in the United States. That goes back to 1914. How to keep that current? Well, we do it by being able to update. In this corner, we have a flat screen television, some other monitors, and we just whatever seems to be newsworthy, we'll put up there some long term, short term stuff. So at least keep the exhibit up to date. Mm-hmm. Having said that, typical the American by Air exhibit took 11 years to make, start to finish. And that's not a particularly long period of time for a significant exhibit. That's one of our main galleries.
Mm-hmm.
Some smaller ones take 3 to 4 years, sometimes five. But this day and age, it's about funding. And you have to raise the money first.
Right.
And that gallery was, all things considered, not all that bad money-wise. It was about $5 million.
Mm.
And there's some that cost a lot more in other museums.
And how about history? Do you have to do it more often or not?
Well, no, we have, I think, in a similar fashion, we have some long-term exhibitions and then changing exhibitions. We have identified some major themes in American history, and we want to make sure that our exhibits, long-term exhibits, reflect those themes, four of those themes that are particularly important to me. One is the story of political freedom. Second is the impact of military conflict. Third is the influence of enterprise and innovation in American history. And fourth is our diverse cultural traditions. So those would be anchor themes that we would want to have, make sure we have long-term exhibitions. And we're still, if you were at the museum, you see we're still rebuilding sections of the museum. But when we finish, those four themes will be very self-evident. And in the center is the Star-Spangled Banner, which is
beautiful,
an enduring permanent exhibit, which I hope will be there for many, many decades. And then we have short-term exhibits, the birth, celebrate the bicentennial of Lincoln's birth. We had the Lincoln exhibit, which will be up through the end of May after Memorial Day comes down. And then we have other short-term exhibits commemorating various anniversaries. A lot of it does depend on funding, and our different funding sponsors have an expectation if they're going to make a commitment that the exhibit will be up for a certain period of time. So we try to take that into account as well.
Never thought of that.
Yeah. Good morning. This question is for Frank. My name is Tom. I'm from Green Bay. In case you don't know where that is, that they have that football team up there.
My brother-in-law knows, believe you me. He's a rabid Packer backer.
My wife and I had an opportunity to visit the National Aeronautics and Space Museum yesterday, and we took in the IMAX theater, which had one of the programs as the Hubble spacecraft. And I know, you know, through the news broadcasts and that, there's been maintenance problems on that, and they've had to send the shuttles up there to repair it a couple times. And there's been talk of abandoning it because of the expense. And I was wondering what the future of that is, because I was so impressed and it was so informative about, you know, the astronomy and talking about billions of galaxies and billions of stars in these galaxies. It was just amazing.
Well, we've learned an incredible amount from the Hubble. Now, I have to put a little asterisk on whatever I say. I am not an expert in the space side. I'm an aviation curator. What I know, I've picked up in lunchtime conversations with my friends in space history down the hallway. I believe the Hubble will be shut down pretty soon, but it's been up for over 20 years. It's been a long, long time. It's going to be replaced by something. I don't remember the name, unfortunately, better. And the problem, of course, is with taking the shuttle out of service, there's no way to maintain anything right now. So it's really a question of the future of what we wish to do about a manned space program, what it can and can't do. One advantage of having the space shuttle was that, first off, it launched the Hubble along with lots of many, many other satellites. And more importantly, they could go up and work on it, which they did, and brought it back into service after it had the corrective lens problem to start with, and then just updates and improvements and the like. Last I understood, it will be shut down and allowed to be destroyed, but yeah. It was going to be replaced by something.
Yeah, we don't know what, though.
I don't. I'm sure some caller probably knows for sure. I just don't remember the name
of
the
book. We'll do a show on it.
Yes.
For you and many others.
We're not going
promise.
To lose that astronomy, yeah. Which is just
it's amazing.
Unbelievable.
It is, yeah. They don't know how to promote themselves well enough.
Well, it's what they've accomplished, I forget how
just incredible.
Much farther out into the universe to be able to look, and the new spacecraft's going to be able to look even farther. Mm.
I was interested, Brent, in something you say. Well, I'm interested in everything you say here, but when you talked about your special interest being the impact of military conflict, which I think that is something mm-hmm. that's been striking to all of us as we've toured Gettysburg and looked at a lot of exhibits of the Civil War and Revolutionary War and World War II and went to the monuments. Mm-hmm. And it, of course, would have an impact on your museum as well because of the space rush and military conflict all over the world. It has been an enormous enormous presence in American life, hasn't it? And I don't know how to take it in fully. Mm-hmm. It just you keep saying simple things, but they're not simple. Is why do we have to keep doing this over and over and over and horrendous deaths and disrupting everything? It has had a huge impact, and I wanted you to talk more about that.
Well, I think that we devote something like 18,000 square feet of the space in the museum for that one exhibit called The Price of Freedom, Americans at War, which covers 250 years of military conflict. And then we have one of my favorite objects in the museum is the gunboat Philadelphia, which is located in the same wing of the museum, which is the oldest warship in America. And the story of bringing that boat into the museum is a great story, because it had to be lifted by a crane and brought in through the window as the museum was being built in 1964. But the gunboat Philadelphia is interesting also because of its connection with Benedict Arnold. And Benedict Arnold, before he went to the other side, was a hero of the American Revolution. He led led troops in some very important conflicts. And one of our other theatrical performances we have is a young actor who plays Benedict Arnold and tries to plead his case to our visitors that he has been mistreated in history and really should be remembered as a hero rather than as a traitor. He did sell the plans for West Point to the British, and that's what he's remembered for during the American Revolution. The problem is he's so convincing that the visitors are somewhat intimidated by him, and so they don't challenge him enough.
Oh.
But we work that out with another member of our staff who challenges him and gets him to admit that he was not totally a hero in the American Revolution. Getting back to your question, though, and I think one point I like to make to people is, if you look at every conflict in American history, our adversaries are now our friends, starting with the American Revolution, on through the Mexican War, Spanish-American War, World War I, World War II, Korea, at least South Korea, is our friend. Vietnam, we have tourists now going to Vietnam. So the only hope, I think, when you take away from all this carnage that you see and violence and death and destruction, is that ultimately we somehow, things settle down and we are able to establish normal relations with many of our adversaries.
And what about in the Air and Space Museum? How do you see military conflict and the amount, the number of years we've spent in military conflict? How does it play out in your museum?
Oh, it's a significant part of our collection.
Yeah.
We have probably the best collection of World War II aircraft in the world. And I mean, not just American stuff. We have the best collection of German and Japanese aircraft. Matter of fact, we have examples of just about everything. And they don't exist anywhere else in the world. So we're aware of that, and we have those aircraft on display here and at our Udvar-Hazy Center. And we have exhibits on World War I and World War II, and obviously we have aircraft from Korea and Vietnam and subsequent that out at Udvar-Hazy Center. Our only problem with discussing modern warfare is a modern aircraft is so big, it literally cannot fit in the building downtown. So we have to discuss mostly the more current affairs out at the Udvar-Hazy Center. Although, just recently, within the last 2 years, we opened an exhibit about UAVs, the unmanned aerial vehicles, which have become so important in the current type of conflict, the limited warfare with all different rules and regulations and dealing with the conflicts. And these have proven to be highly useful and valuable in combat. But, yes, we... About half our collection is military. Mm. You know, the irony is the Wright brothers invented the airplane thinking it would be a tool for peace. Igor Sikorsky pioneered his helicopter with the thought that it would be for peaceful purposes. And in both cases, mankind being what mankind is, has found ways of militarizing it.
Right. Let's pause a moment and we'll return and welcome. I think we might be able to try the phones, and we certainly have an engaged audience here too. So we will go to our studio audience. Here's our phone number. I should be giving that number again, and we'll take a few calls. 800-486-8655 is a number. I'm Kathleen Dunn, and we have two guests with us this hour. We have Brent Glass, director of the National Museum of American History, a wonderful place to go while you're in Washington, and also Bob Vanderlinden, who is chair of the Aeronautics Division for the National Air and Space Museum, all part of the Smithsonian. I'm Kathleen Dunn. We are broadcasting live today from this perfectly quiet studio. It's just so quiet. I feel like we're off in a space capsule. It's very nice. And we're broadcasting live from Studio 4A at NPR. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we're going to take a phone call. Eugene from Viola. Hi, Eugene.
Good morning, Kathleen. Hi. I have another question. I realize you're running short on time, so I have another question besides the one I ran by the screener. Recently, I saw an article on the Internet that they may have found the plane in the South Pacific that Amelia Earhart flew. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, it slipped off the radar, and I haven't heard anything about that.
Okay.
I was wondering if your guests there knew anything about that.
Well, Bob?
I haven't heard about that recently. There have been people going out looking for the aircraft for decades now. There was an exhibition just a couple of years ago that went out and didn't find anything. Some have been looking on islands. Some have been looking in the ocean. There's been no conclusive evidence that she has been found. That much I do know.
Okay, to our studio audience from Wisconsin.
Yeah, my name is Barb. I live in Madison right now, but originally from Butternut. And my question is to either one of you, what's on your bucket list for your museums? You know, before you finish your term, what would you like to accomplished or, mm-hmm. or collected?
Good one. Well, for me, I must say we have an excellent, a superb collection. We're very lucky in having that. And we're very fortunate that we have this large facility out at Dulles. And we're just opening a new phase of it. Literally, I understand today we got occupancy of the building. Well, we can move into the building. That's where our shop will be and a lot of storage. Ultimately, though, if we could double or triple the space we have out there, we could put everything we have on display, that we own on display. Most people don't understand that most museums can only put at most 10% of their collections on display. American history has some fabulous things that you'll never see unless you come in and specifically ask to see it. We're the same way. We are lucky in that we have about 80% of our aircraft are visible on display, but we have another 40,000 objects and we do our best to get out there so you can see it. But we need just more room. As it stands right now, with the 40, 50 airplanes we have on loan, we still have another 50 aircraft in storage when we get our HASI facility all fleshed out. Ideally, double, triple it, so I can collect, so we can just keep collecting into the future. You know, and we have to. And the problem, as I mentioned earlier, what we collect is big, very big. You know, we collect the uniforms and the buttons and the pins and that sort of stuff, too, which are extremely important. But, right now, we did manage to get the nose of a 747 on display downtown. That was no mean feat. It came in 4 trucks.
Oh, my.
And 8, 9 pieces. But it's only the first 35 feet of the nose. That airplane is extremely significant. Just the 747 has changed the world.
How has it changed the world?
It made air travel affordable for everybody.
Oh.
It wasn't until then. Now you could carry almost 400 people, and it drove the cost way down.
Hmm.
It was just much more efficient.
Mm-hmm.
Up until then, the wealthy or the upper middle class were the only ones who could fly. Nowadays, and that technology has trickled on down throughout all the entire industry. If you can scrape $50 or $100 together, you can fly just about anywhere.
Hmm.
If you shop. If you're not ready to shop, you could get nailed for $1,000. But that's capitalism. But that's what I'd like to be able to do. As I said, we have a wonderful collection. We need to bring in some more military aircraft. We have an F-14, but when the F-15 and 16 are retired, obviously a huge impact and a lot of use they've had. If the Boeing 787 proves to be as significant as promised, being the first all-composite aircraft, which if it does change the face of air travel, we'll definitely need one at some point, mm-hmm. or at least parts of one.
Brent, how about you?
Well, we will continue to collect. That's what museums do, is collect evidence of the past and also of our own times. So I don't have a particular wish of something that I feel that's missing in the museum. I am more concerned about making the museum to improve the museum so that we can better display what we have. And we have a major renovation scheduled starting next year for the west side of our museum. We'll create new galleries for business history, for political history, and for cultural history. And then I want to make the collection we have more accessible to the public, especially using the new digital technology we have, electronic technology, so that everything can be accessible on the internet with good information. And that usually will encourage people to want to come and see the real thing. As Bob said, we don't display only a very small percentage of what we have. I do like to say we display 100% of the Star-Spangled Banner. and then beyond that, the percentages go down significantly. But I think better galleries and better access is on my wish list.
Let's go to another caller, Fred in La Crosse. Hi, Fred.
Hello.
Yes, hi, Fred.
Oh, hi. Yeah, just thought I'd call and share with your audience some Wisconsin connections to your to the Air and Space Museum.
Okay.
For example, I worked for Train, and so I know that during World War II, Train air conditioning, we built the intercooler for the P-47 that you have on display. We built a radiator for the P-51 Mustang. I think you have one of those on display.
Yes, we do.
We also built an exhaust gas heat exchanger for the P-61 Night Fighter.
Got that, too.
And later on, we built a heat exchanger for the Lunar Moon Buggy.
And we have those.
Yeah, and if that's not enough, Train provides the complete air conditioning system for the Udvar Hazy Center.
Well, thank you very much, because it does a great job.
Thank you, Fred. Thank you very much for your call. I got to talk about a couple of the cultural things that are in the History Museum. Why would you include, although it's just delightful, the red slippers that Judy Garland mm-hmm. wore? They're just beautiful.
Yeah, the ruby slippers are probably among the top five artifacts that people want to see.
Really?
And if I ever take the ruby slippers off display, my job would be in peril. And I think the reason for it, and it's interesting, and I recommend to people that there's a biography of Frank Baum, the author of The Wizard of Oz, that came out a couple of years ago. And The Wizard of Oz, I think, is an American folktale. It's the counterpart to the Grimm Brothers folktales or Alice in Wonderland, and it really touches on a lot of themes in American life, the Midwest, that I think is very prominently featured in that. And I think it's a rich story. It's not just the movie. The books were very popular in the early part of the 20th century. I was just reading James Franco, the prominent young actor, and he was asked what his favorite books are. He said the Wizard of Oz series. Oh. So I think the Wizard of Oz really is something that for a lot of Americans, and not so much for international audiences, but for Americans, they really relate very closely to that whole question of, and it goes back to the American dream. You know, there's no place like home. This whole attachment to home is really quite basic mm. and very emotional. And so I think that's why people mm-hmm. Relate so closely to the ruby slippers.
We're heading there today. We're going home. I don't want to yet, though. But we are going home. And what is it about the dresses? I did go to the dresses. I didn't think I would, but I looked at the shoes. I looked at the jewelry. I looked at the dresses. Why are we – that has to be way high on the list of where people go in the History Museum.
That's the other exhibit that we closed that – it's interesting. We closed the museum for 2 years, from 2006 to 2008.
Really?
And it gives me a chance to mention also that we work closely with our counterpart museums at the Smithsonian. During that time when we were closed for renovation, Air and Space Museum made a gallery available to us to showcase what we called the treasures of American history, which included the
Very
ruby
nice.
Slippers.
We had the ruby slippers.
And
we got their crowd.
and no one asked, what does this have to do with air and space history? They were very happy to have
funny.
It.
That's funny.
But when we...
remember the
when
flying
we,
monkeys.
That's yeah, that's right. And the scarecrow. We had the scarecrow costume and some other things. But when we reopened the museum, we could only at the time open a very small gallery for the First Lady's gowns. And we received so many complaints from visitors, very, very upset that we didn't have more of that collection out. And unfortunately, in the... last year, Mrs. Obama gave us her gown, and that gave us an opportunity to expand the gallery to showcase the last, I think it's the last 11 first ladies, from Mamie Eisenhower to Michelle Obama.
It's great.
And the complaints dropped completely.
Good. All right. Thank you both so much for being with us. Our thanks to Brent Glass, who's director of the National Museum of American History, Smithsonian, and Bob Vanderlinden, who's chair of Aeronautics Division, National Air and Space, and Smithsonian. That wraps it up. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for doing a whole lot of work for producing this show, and Chrissy Pease, Siobhan Montgomery Brown for making this possible. To all the people at NPR, thank you so much for hosting us and being gracious with us. Neil, our engineer, I don't know your last name, I'm sorry. And thanks, everybody, for getting on the bus.